Tate Chronicles now transmitting.
Welcome to the Tate Chronicles on Healthcare Now Radio. And now, here's your host, Jim Tate.
Good day, citizens of the free world, from border to border, coast to coast, and to all the ships at sea. I bring you a warm welcome. This is your correspondent, Jim Tate, and thank you for tuning into the Tate Chronicles. Join me as we cut through the fog that exists at the leading edge of healthcare technology. My guest today is Nick King. Nick is the CEO and founder of Data Kinetic. Data Kinetic is a company that offers platform-agnostic, industry-focused, applied AI research, development, and advisory services. Nick, thanks for joining the Tate Chronicles.
Thank you, Jim. It's a real pleasure to be here.
I know Data Kinetic is involved with AI in a number of different industries, but today we're going to focus on your work related to healthcare. I was reading, Nick, recently an announcement that Data Kinetic has an applied AI solution suite for the healthcare industry. So let's talk about that a little bit, as well as some of the use cases this offering addresses. One of the ones that was kind of interesting to me was CMS fraud detection. How does that work? What's going on with CMS fraud detection and AI and your services?
Yeah, I think the CMS fraud detection one is very interesting. And you know, these programs are immensely large. And what we found was that the ability to, detect, CMS does a fantastic job. I actually was just reading one of the reports a couple of days ago about how they're able to identify, malicious intent or even a malicious intent that may be, on the bubble. Mm. But the complexity is that usually that's discovered post-payment. And, that lag between the data being reconciled, the trends being recognized, and being able to do something about it, and often cases is, 6, 8, 10 weeks before that gets recognized. And as you know, once the money's been moved around, it makes it a much more complicated conversation to start to do that. So what we recognized was if we could use various models and algorithms and approaches, we were able to start to flag transactions that may not be consistent with what we were expecting. And so the model itself is actually built out of what we would call a factor. Think of a factor as like you have a ICD-10 code that's an injury to a thumb.
Okay.
And what else is related to that thumb injury? And it creates what's called a graph, like a knowledge graph that relates to that. And so that allows us to start to set up all these factors and then create a graph that surrounds it. So the beauty of this approach, without getting too nerdy on it, is that rather than having to go through the full cycle, the different parties are able to start to recognize that there may be something anomalous about this. And it's not saying people are doing things wrong. Like in most cases, people are trying to do the right thing and something might get miscoded. Mm-hmm. There could be some compassionate grounds. There's lots of factors that go into it. But what we really notice when we dive deep into CMS fraud is there are some really, unfortunate people out there that do bad things, and they generally tend to target, unfortunately, vulnerable populations. And so we really felt that there was an opportunity there, one, to prove, that there are new ways of approaching this, but also that, a lot of these types of fraud activities are not an individual themselves. Unfortunately, like true fraud is an organized behavior. There's usually multiple actors in that state, which is why taking a graph and a relationship view is so critical. I think the second point there is we kind of look at the market and look at what's changing. We have an aging population. We have a shifting policy of how, things like immigration is handled, things like how different drugs are administered. And those constant changes and claims edits are also very complicated for individuals and organizations to keep handle of. So that's why we focused on that. Also, we have an ethos, which is focus on the things that are practical and actionable versus kind of trying to you know, build something from 10 years from now that that could potentially cause cancer. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's just that for us, we felt that, you know, how do we make the most amount of impact with providers and all the different parties as soon as possible?
You know, I kind of divide AI and healthcare into two domains, Nick. One is what I call, for lack of a better term, back office, and one is direct patient care. And so let's just stay with the back office a little bit. I know you're, and I love the term applied AI, because AI is not going to do us much good unless it's applied. Hospital patient volume forecasting. How is using AI to address that challenge any different from the traditional models of trying to forecast patient volume in a hospital?
Yeah, I love that you picked up the applied piece. So when we say applied, you know, applied isn't a research paper. It's not just a data science. It's actually been inside the organization. It's running, it's trusted, it's auditable. Mm-hmm. That adds a lot more complexity to what we do. A lot of our models are based off work we've done either for the government or different organizations. And so naturally, they are highly secure and designed to be placed in that environment. And, you know, the second part here of thinking about how we look at applied is there's realities on the ground that are hard for, you know, an isolated mathematical model to take advantage of. So I'll give you a little bit of secret sauce. So mm-hmm. It turns out there are public data sets that exist that can be pretty good indicators. The obvious one is, like, let's look at Twitter. Let's look at news. What we found was that what people search for on the internet by zip code is actually a very powerful indicator of something happening, right? So let's say there is a concert that's happening in the area. Let's say that there may be a protest in the area. There could be preparation for a protest in the area. Those may have an implication on how the ER might be behaving. And traditionally, these models, what they do is they look for a seasonality effect, right? You might have storms. There might be the 4th mm-hmm. of July, which is always a big pop. And so you want to start to look at not only what are the localized trends that could forecast that demand, but also you want to make sure that the skill sets are also matched. And we also hear a lot about burnout. And I just want to give a shout out to the healthcare professionals. I spend a lot of time with them. I know why they're burned out. Like, it's really hard, right? And, you know, people can be pretty horrible, some of these practitioners, and all they want to do is make you happy and healthy and go home. And we found that with the staffing concerns and everything else, if we could get that staffing to the appropriate level so that, you know, the costs of that are well managed, but the care quality is increasing, that's a really important thing. And so we take multiple factors, you know, not just historical trends, but also, like, can we take some real world data feeds and do things with it? And that extends to multiple departments, not just the ER. It can also go to the OR. We can also look at, you know, things like diabetes and what's happening there. We're pretty excited about what GLP-1s can do to community health as well. And so those are all factors, right? If you're seeing a large amount of interest in Ozempic and a cheaper version of Ozempic comes out and more of the populations are able to address that, that will change the dynamics of how these providers need to staff that and ultimately allows them to go hire the right people and make sure people don't get burned out, which none of us want to see.
You know, Nick, one of the first examples that I really became aware of, I don't know if it was AI, I wouldn't call it AI maybe, but it was certainly predictive, is during the early years of the COVID pandemic, it was possible to go into Google Analytics to a particular zip code and see the number of people who were searching on COVID symptoms.
Correct.
And then there would be, I don't know if it was 5 to 7 days later, a bubble in hospital admissions.
Yes, sir.
So, and influenza is the same thing. I mean, it's yep. kind of interesting how that's worked out.
Yeah. I used to work at Google. And so we used to have a tool that would, we could type in the name of a restaurant and we could see how many people had asked did I get food poisoning from this restaurant?
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so, yeah. So you're right. Like, human behavior is really key. You know, the other interesting one is drug interactions. So what's the first place you go if you've had a drug that might be giving you an erection? You go to the internet. What's the next thing you do? You go to Twitter and be like, hey, I'm feeling ill. And so, you know, I've seen this in other locations, in particular the Middle East, where they monitor those social channels to try and understand drug interactions and other elements. And that is a far larger sample than some of the research that goes out there. Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Before we go into any more use cases, who are your customers? Who's using your services? Is it large hospital systems or universities?
Yeah, I think for a large part, we're working with government organizations. Mm-hmm. Again, shout out to those folks, right? Like CMS, HHS, they do amazing work. They're some of the smartest analysts I've ever worked with. They're so helpful. They come at it from a both practical but also high fidelity data standpoint. We're also working with specialists in cardiac surgery, and we're also looking at ER departments and other OR departments more. You know, there's a phase that I think most people know exists, but after you have a procedure, there's a series of charting and coding and reconciliation with payers, and we're working with some of those providers to also provide additional insights. And unfortunately, the way that payers respond, they have these codes called X12 codes. And an X12 code is kind of like a termination, like we'll not pay, we'll pay, renegotiate, what have you. Mm-hmm. But every single payer has the same code book, but the codes mean something slightly different. And so we're also looking at those types of use cases. And you're probably wondering, Nick, this is so back office. Why are you focusing on this when you could be focusing on other things? We wanted to stay really practical.
Yeah.
Right. If we can reduce the burden on billing, you know, that could potentially allow those teams to be more efficient, hospitals to be more profitable, payers to be more efficient because they're, you know, paying the right size amount. And it all is, you know, compounding alpha to drive, you know, ultimately a better state of healthcare.
Well, let me say to our audience, if you're just joining us, I'm Jim Tate. And on this episode of the Tate Chronicles, I'm speaking with none other than Nick King of Data Kinetic. You mentioned back office. Let's talk about, I guess, for lack of a term, front office, but yep. Things more related to patients directly.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, one of the big things we hear more about with AI is tumor detection, automated visual pathology. Tell me a little bit what's going on there.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually a bit of a skeptic of using AI to solve all of these, you know, radiology multimodality use cases. I think there's going to be a point in time where, sure, it can get, you know, very close. Where we've been focusing more is on false negatives. And the reason for false negatives is, you know, the population of, say, the US is very different to the population of, say, ASA or Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. Or other locations. And so what we looked at was, you know, as you have these different tools being run, and I'll use mammography as an example, usually when a mammogram scan is done, it's actually sent to two radiologists, and they effectively do a double-blind assessment of the scan to make sure nothing's missed. Now, if you were to add an AI to that, we're like, well, can we also look for false negative detection? And false negative detection is one, the risk you never want to assume, right? You never want to say, hey, there was nothing here and something was here.
Yes.
And the beauty of that is that, you know, we're able to really look at, you know, those pathologies and make insights from them and provide additional, let's just call it audit data or, hey, take another look data. I'm also, you know, I think I don't believe that AI will replace practitioners, nurses, and doctors. And the reason for that is there's so much other information that exists outside of the medical record or the DICOM image or other pieces. And there's also a lot of data that exists that is in the workflow. So in Mammo, you know, you have a screening scan, you'll have a much more in-depth, you know, if something is anomalous, there's a much more, you know, deeper investigatory scan. From there might be an aerated biopsy. From there might be a lymph node biopsy. Those systems and those integrations, the speed at which you can execute those end-to-end is really critical. So when we think about AVP, we're not just thinking about, you know, the screening scan. We're also looking at, okay, how do we make sure that an at-risk population is being addressed? How do we make sure they come in and get their scan? How do we make sure they get their results? And how do we make sure we guarantee that if the results are within a certain threshold, they're coming back for that, you know, deeper investigation, deeper follow-up? And it sounds like a small thing, but think about how your appointments get scheduled today, right? You go in, someone phones you up. I'm really busy, so I very rarely answer my phone. And so, you know, at the end of like a busy couple of days, I'm rapidly going through voicemails trying to reconcile like when I'm scheduled to get X, Y, or Z. And so when we start to look at AVP as an entire life cycle, there's a huge opportunity here to reduce the administrative burden on these organizations, but also begin to provide many more statistics on number of times outreach, maybe this modality, maybe a text message or maybe a phone call, or maybe calling up someone's medical proxy is a better way of ensuring that those tests and care plans are executed. And generally, if you do that well, you know, versus doing it not well, there should be a more positive path to outcome.
You know, one of the things that concerns me, Nick, when we have AI systems that have been trained on DICOM images, radiographic images, or really trained on any type of clinical information, the data that the systems have been trained on, what's the basis of that data? You know, we certainly have a lot of clinical trials for pharmaceuticals that were based on trial participants from European DNA. Mm-hmm. For lack of a better term. And so I guess that is one thing, you know, transparency of how these models are trained, the data that they're trained on.
Yeah, exactly.
And tumor detection, I would think that the vast majority of the training that takes place on images, and I'm not sure how it happens, but it's probably people who, or certainly scans, who have insurance.
Yeah.
So it's not including folks who don't have insurance or don't go get a scan. So do you have any thoughts about how that's going to be worked out? Or we just move slowly in that direction and do no harm?
Yeah. Oh, I love this question. So, okay. So yes, you're 100% right. So the data sets are, this word bias means a lot of things, but I'll talk about bias in a data set versus sort of a social set.
Yes.
You have confirmation bias. You know, a lot of these studies are designed to confirm a certain cohort that may react best to that care plan or that treatment plan. And, you know, I think what we're finding is that there is increasingly new ways of checking not only, you know, the shape, but also the density. There's some really cool ultrasound technology coming out, which does like multiple waves. You can kind of check fibrosis as well as other techniques. And so we shift into a world which we call multimodal. And multimodal means that, you know, you're able to capture a lot more, but then you're also able to begin to train on specific data sets. So I mentioned KSA, or the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. You know, their genetics, everything else is slightly different to ours, right? Their cultural norms are slightly different to ours. So I can't take a US data set and just deploy it, even if it's FDA approved, into KSA. And, you know, that's a very broad international example. But, you know, look at our own diversity in population. And you're right, there are folks that are uninsured or may not have access to the same depth in testing. Right. Now, what we find is that care plans and test plans generally are applied at a protocol level. And so if you look at those protocols and treat them as almost like an archetype for how you should be looking at a broad population, then what really the opportunity is with AI, and I'm going to use AI broadly and all the subcomponents of it, I really do believe that in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see the ability to customize or personalize those care plans to your risk profile. And the source data for that doesn't have to be image data, right? Social determinants of health have a big impact here. I would also say, you know, we can genuinely tell really in your mid-40s what your health and behavioral patterns are looking like, what potentially your family history may look like, and that could adjust the care plan. But if, you know, the standard protocol doesn't necessarily include some of that, then there will be disadvantaged communities, those that may not have insurance, those that may be in lower socioeconomic classes. And so I think, you know, for us, looking at how we can bring those factors together and do so in the most important piece, which has been traceable. So what worries me a lot about AI is everyone builds this great AI product. It's top secret. This is their magic secret sauce. We believe in open sourcing a lot of our stuff. So we'll actually run people through it, show them how it works. There's like very clear audit trails. All of our models, we never see the data. We actually inflate them inside the customer's environment. Mm-hmm. And all of those decisions were made so that these aren't black boxes. You know, one of the key things about, you know, our healthcare system is informed consent. Well, you know, if what an AI model looks like for informed consent is a series of, you know, tables that have unintelligible numbers. And it's very hard to deliver informed consent based on a table which is all zeros and ones.
Absolutely. Let me mention one other, I guess for lack of a better term, a back office, and how applied AI may be involved. Medical supply chain, that's a big issue.
Yes, sir.
And there are many ways for there to be a slip there or a pinch point. How can AI improve that medical supply chain?
Yeah, I think medical supply chain, you know, the example all of us will be very familiar with COVID, right? So there was a shortage of PPE. There's a shortage of a number of different elements. You know, I think for medical supply chain, you're looking at certain disciplines and wanting to ensure that, you know, what needs to be available is available. But at the same time, you don't want overstocking, right? So hospitals have to carry a huge inventory. You know, some of that inventory, you know, has to go to waste, and because, you know, you can't reuse things, which is absolutely appropriate. But you want to be able to start to understand not only that medical supply chain, but what is the remaining useful life of some of those assets, right? And protocols change sometimes. And I think even there's like provider to provider, like the heads of departments may have ways that they want to do things. And so being able to create, again, this personalized level of like, okay, you know, make sure we tend to use these more for STEMIs or other types of heart conditions. Let's make sure those are on staff available. Let's also make sure we have an idea of the lead time for some of these products, right? You've all heard stories of like, you know, CT machines being down for 3 weeks while we wait for parts to come from Japan or somewhere else.
Yes.
And so understanding not just the supply chain of your own organization, but is it possible to transfer to another location? And so these models are, you know, we use them in supply chain often and what's called hierarchical supply chain management. So imagine you're a Walmart and you have millions of SKUs. How do you ensure that there's always, you know, a SKU there so you've got a pair of shoes that will fit a size 11 man shoe? Well, that sounds really easy, but, you know, all the upstream and downstream components that are incredibly complicated. So we look at the, we break down the hierarchies being different departments. We then start looking at, okay, what are the trends of this department? And then we optimize that model versus what I think happens today is that, you know, you make sure you always have 100 on stock and someone goes and order it and then orders another 45 and kind of keeps them topped up, which works. Yes. But now you're maintaining a potentially something you could get overnight. You're maintaining, you know, a 6 month supply, and that stuff, that medicine may expire in a year. So, you know, of those 100, unfortunately, it's first in, first out, or last in, first out. Mm. So there's always a couple of bits at the back that never get addressed. And so you can get a lot more efficiency in medical supply chain by being much more aware of, like, okay, like, what's the stocking unit? What are we looking at? How do we have a more effective carry? And then can you then provide that in the right way? Without, which is most important, being at a point where you can't find what you need.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we're almost totally out of time, but I've got one more question for you, Nick.
Yes, sir.
How can our listeners find out more about the services offered by Data Kinetic? How can they find you?
So website's really good, datakinetic.com, datakinetic.com. Or you can email me directly, which is nick@datakinetic.com. We're very open. We always love to talk to folks with ideas, with problems. You know, as you mentioned, we work in multiple disciplines, multiple industries. But what that allows us to do is that often what we may learn in, say, another industry can be readily applied to the healthcare sector. And, you know, the team, you know, I started way back in 2001 building models. And so we've got a pretty big back catalog, which we don't publish, which can often be very helpful for folks. And our ultimate goal is to help people. So, you know, send me an email, get in touch on the website. We're always around. We'll be at HIMSS. We're trying to be as available as possible because, you know, we want to do no harm. We want to help these people. And honestly, my experience is this profession, everyone's curious and has true, honest intent of doing better every single day to make people happier and healthier.
Well, and truly, we're really just at the very first, not even chapters, very first pages of the first chapter in applied healthcare, especially in AI. So there are a lot of lessons to be learned that are in our future. To our audience, thanks for joining me on this episode of the Tate Chronicles. I offer a special salute to my guest today, Nick King of Data Kinetic. Nick, thanks for coming aboard today.
I really appreciate it, Jim. Thanks for the amazing questions, and thanks for everything you do for the community. It's honorable, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Nick. You can find more information on this show's program page at healthcarenowradio.com. That's healthcarenowradio.com. Until we meet again, here's wishing you smooth sailing and safe harbors.
Tate Chronicles transmission ending now.